All right, let's jump into this deep dive. You sent over an investment update, and honestly, it's grabbed our attention.
Oh, yeah.
It's not just like looking at dry numbers, you know?
Right.
It's like getting a peek into how someone actually invests, their style.
Interesting.
And they're focused on some big names, too.
Ugh.
Procter & Gamble, British
Yeah.
American Tobacco, and even Anheuser-Busch InBev.
A good mix. Let's see what we can find.
Let's break it down. Okay, so first off, the way this portfolio is structured is pretty neat.
Yeah, it's divided into three categories.
Hit me with them.
Aishin, which is for those stable blue chip stocks. Motor for high growth potential. And then Favorit'in, I'm guessing those are newer, maybe more exciting picks.
Okay, I like it. So like they've got their reliable workhorses, the ones that are meant to like zoom ahead, and then their dark horses, right?
Exactly. And on top of that, they're sitting on a pretty big cash position right now, 24%.
Whoa. To me, that's like screaming, waiting for the right moment.
It definitely signals a strategic approach, you know? Like
Yeah.
they're biding their time, waiting for the market to shift.
I see, I see. Okay, well, should we start with Procter and Gamble then? That's the first company on the list. P&G, the ultimate household name.
Yeah, P&G's delivered a solid 102% stock price growth.
Wow.
And if you factor in dividends, the total return jumps to 137% over the last 10 years.
No kidding.
That even beats out Coca-Cola, which had 46% and 82% respectively.
Dang, not too shabby at all.
Not at all. And their recent performance is pretty noteworthy too, especially considering the economic climate.
Yeah, what's the story there?
Well, they managed 2% organic sales growth in the first quarter of 2025, mainly due to price increases,
Organic meaning.
meaning growth that doesn't include things like acquisitions or currency fluctuations, just pure sales performance.
Gotcha.
But it's interesting though, because their Japanese skincare brand, SK-II, actually took a bit of a hit in China.
Oh, why is that?
Well, it seems like it was due to the anti-Japan sentiment that cropped up after that whole Fukushima water release.
Wow, so even these huge global players like P&G, they're not immune to those kinds of geopolitical ripples, huh?
Nope, it just goes to show external factors always play a role.
For sure.
But to P&G's credit, their resilience is pretty remarkable.
What makes you say that?
Well, even during the pandemic, their organic sales growth averaged a pretty healthy 6%.
Okay, so they can weather the storms.
Plus, their innovation game is really strong.
Meaning.
They've launched a bunch of new products since 2020, like King C. Gillette, Microbar 24, and they even acquired Meal Organics.
Ah, I see. So they're not just sitting back, they're actively trying to stay ahead of the curve.
Exactly. And that consistent rollout of new stuff, it really sets them apart from a company like Coca-Cola, which might explain the difference in performance.
So it's not just about being a household name. It's about actively staying relevant, giving people new things to get excited about. Makes me wonder, though, what's their strategy here? Are they just chasing every trend, or is there a more focused approach?
That is the million-dollar question, right? But looking at their launches, there's definitely a mix.
Like what?
Well, you've got premiumization with King C. Gillette, a play for the whole hygiene thing with Microban 24, and then tapping into the natural hair care trend with Meal Organics.
Easy, so it's not all in on one thing.
It seems more like they're hedging their bets across several high-growth segments, not putting all their eggs in one basket, so to speak.
Smart move, covering more ground that way. Okay, well, from reliable, steady P&G, we're shifting gears to British American Tobacco.
All right.
Now, this feels like a bit of a gamble, right?
It's where the analysis starts to get really interesting. The investor compares BT to Philip Morris, which they're both tobacco giants, similar revenue, but BAT's market cap, so the total value of all their shares, is less than half of Philip Morris's. $85 billion versus $207 billion. It's like, what gives?
Yeah, that's a huge difference. There's got to be something driving that gap, right?
Yeah.
Beyond just cigarettes.
The key difference seems to be their approach to non-combustible products. Philip Morris has really embraced this market with things like their IQOS heated tobacco system,
Right.
and those products now make up a whopping 40% of their revenue and profit.
So they're riding the wave of changing consumer habits while BAT's, well, are they dragging their feet?
They're definitely playing catch up. BAT's non-combustible segment is only at 18.5% of revenue and only just turned profitable in 2023. They do have their own heated tobacco product, the Glo Hyper Pro, but it just hasn't taken off like IQOS.
But I get the feeling our investor sees some potential there, right?
Yeah.
Otherwise, why even bother?
Oh, they're definitely bullish on BAT.
Holy.
They acknowledge they're lagging behind, but they point to that much lower valuation as an attractive entry point. BT's trading at a price-to-earnings ratio, you know, the KGV, of 8 compared to Philip Morris's 21.
So it's a contrarian bet, hoping that BT will eventually close that non-combustible gap and their stock will, what, take off?
Precisely. And they're projecting potential returns of 18% per year. That's using a discounted cash flow model, the DCF, or even 32% based on a KGV model.
Oh, big difference there.
And on top of that, BIA has a pretty hefty dividend yield of 7.8%, which has been consistently increasing for 26 years straight.
Okay, so high risk, high reward potential, lots to think about there. Now, for the last company in this update, Anheuser-Busch InBev. I'm already sensing a hold on to your hats moment here.
ABI is where the investor admits to some disappointment.
Oh.
It's actually down 21% in their portfolio currently.
Oof.
However, they still have faith. They even bring up the idea of Schmerzensgeld.
Schmerzensgeld, what is that?
It means pain money. It's basically the belief that initial pain can lead to future gains.
Interesting. So a bit of a bumpy ride so far, but they're not jumping ship just yet. But to understand why, I guess we need to understand where they stand in the market, right?
Absolutely. ABI is massive. They produce nearly 600 million hectoliters of beer every year.
That's a lot of beer.
For context, the global total is under 2 billion.
Wow. So they hold a significant chunk of the market.
Yeah.
But how are they actually performing lately? Are people still drinking all that beer?
Well, their volume sales have been flat, but their revenue is still up by 2.5%. And get this. Their underlying earnings per share actually jumped 18.4% in the first 9 months of 2024.
Wait, so more profit even though they're selling the same amount of beer? That's a neat trick. How are they pulling that off?
It seems their non-beer products are driving that growth, offsetting the slight dip in beer sales.
Ah, so they're diversifying.
Exactly, and it's paying off. Plus, here's a fun fact. Their non-alcoholic Corona Cero actually became an Olympic sponsor this year. Alongside Coca-Cola.
Corona Cero at the Olympics. Talk about a marketing win.
Right. But that does raise the question of how their other brands are doing, especially after that whole Bud Light situation.
Yeah, for sure.
There have definitely been some bumps in the road. Michelob Ultra is doing really well. It's now ranked 6th globally.
Okay.
But Bud Light, well, they face some challenges.
Right, right.
But overall, their brand portfolio is still strong.
How so?
Well, Corona is actually topping global beer sales right now.
Wow, really?
And Budweiser comes in second.
Corona's number one globally. That's wild. I mean, I knew it was popular, but I didn't realize it was that popular. How does a Mexican beer reach that kind of worldwide dominance?
It's actually a pretty fascinating story of smart marketing and global expansion. The demand for Corona in Europe is so high that they're actually brewing it locally in Germany now.
Wow. So they're going the extra mile to reach their consumers.
Yeah.
But isn't Germany known for its those strict beer purity laws? How does Corona, with its corn, fit into that?
That's where it gets interesting.
Okay, tell me more.
They couldn't use the traditional Bavarian breweries because Corona uses corn, which clashes with the Reinheitsgebot, that's Germany's beer purity law.
Ah, right.
So they had to find some creative solutions to brew it locally, but still keep the Corona recipe intact.
Adapting to local regulations without sacrificing their brand.
Clever.
What about Budweiser? How are they holding up on, you know, their home turf?
They've got a pretty clever marketing campaign running in England right now. They're featuring the football legend Jeff Hurst playing on the nostalgia of England's World Cup victory back in 1966.
I see.
They even released a limited edition Bring It Home can.
Tapping into national pride and a beloved sport classic. Okay, so we've got this global beer giant with its winners, its strugglers, and its marketing moves. But what's our investors' overall take on ABI? With that 21% dip, are they still holding on to that pain money philosophy, hoping for a turnaround?
They seem to be. They believe the stock is actually undervalued.
Really? Why?
Well, they point to several factors. The massive SABMiller acquisition back in 2016.
Right.
The pandemic's impact. And then the dividend cuts. All of these things have kind of created this negative market perception.
So they're betting on a comeback story. That ABI will shake off these setbacks and soar again.
Exactly. And they see potential for some pretty high returns, too.
Like what?
23% per year based on a DCF model.
Okay.
And 26% according to a KGV model. These are based on the company's strong free cash flow, which is expected to improve as they recover.
All right. Intriguing. So we've got P&G, the steady innovator, BAT, the risky bet, and then ABI, the potential turnaround story. It's like a diversified buffet of investment approaches. But I'm curious about the rest of this investor's portfolio. What's lurking in those Eichen, Motor, and Favorite in categories?
Well, let's dive into that next. So remember those three categories, the Eichen, the Motor, and the Favoriten. This update actually gives us a little peek into the Eichen holdings.
Ooh, interesting. Remind me, Eichen is, what was it again?
Eichen is like your solid oak trees, the dependable ones.
Right, right, the long-term investments. What's going on in that part of the portfolio?
It's a mix, honestly. Some are struggling, some are thriving. They've got Johnson & Johnson and Nestle, for example, and both of those have been kind of declining lately.
Hmm. That sounds like an opportunity for a little bit of buy low, sell high action. But why those two? Are they just hoping they'll bounce back, or is there something more to it?
Well, they specifically mention being interested in their resistance to inflation.
That makes sense with how the economy is looking right now.
Yeah, it's a big concern. And then you've got McDonald's and P&G, both of which are up over 100% in the portfolio.
Okay, so those are the heavy hitters in this category.
Definitely.
I mean, Golden Arches and Everyday Essentials, those are pretty resilient even when times get tough, right? Any other standouts in the Eichen category?
Netflix is a pretty interesting one. It's gone from a 12% gain to a 53% gain.
Wait.
The investor even says they wish they'd bought more when it was cheaper.
Hindsight, right.
But now, at $918 a share, they're a little hesitant. They're actually looking for a price below $800 to add to their position.
So they're not just chasing returns blindly. They're actually being strategic about their entry points. That's impressive discipline, honestly. Any news on BAT or ABI in this Eichen section?
They do mention that BAT has finally crawled out of the negative, which is a good sign for their contrarian bet.
Right.
ABI, on the other hand, is still kind of sliding downwards.
Oof, that must be frustrating considering their optimism about a turnaround.
Yeah, I'd say so.
It's like watching two horses in a race.
Yeah.
One's slowly gaining ground, the other one's kind of lagging behind. What else is happening in this steady Eichen part of the portfolio?
They've also got Gilead, which is a pharmaceutical company. It's done well, going from a 21% gain to a 38% gain.
Nice.
And they're hoping for even stronger performance from them in the coming years.
So the Eichen category is a real mixed bag, huh?
It is.
You've got your stalwarts, your underperformers, some with potential. It's like a mini version of the market as a whole, wouldn't you say?
That's a great point. It highlights the importance of diversification.
Right, spreading your bets.
Exactly. Across different industries, different companies with different risk profiles. That's how you aim for, you know, long-term stability and growth.
Makes sense. Okay, so we've got a good picture of the Eichen holdings now. Mm-hmm. But what about the other two? The Motor and the Favoriten. Any clues about what's in there?
Unfortunately, the update doesn't really dive into those this time around.
Oh, man.
But we can speculate a little based on their descriptions. Motor, remember, that's all about high-growth companies, the ones that are expected to drive the portfolio's returns.
Right, so the motor stocks are the ones they're hoping will really take off and fuel the portfolio's growth, so to speak.
Exactly.
Okay. And what about Favoriten? Are those like their personal favorites, like companies they just, I don't know, have a good feeling about?
Exactly. These are probably newer investments, companies they see as particularly promising, maybe with some groundbreaking product, a disruptive business model, or maybe a strong potential in emerging markets.
I see, I see. So they're not just playing it safe with those Eichen stocks. They're also looking for those hidden gems that could really make a difference in the long run.
You got it. And by putting a portion of their portfolio into these more speculative plays, they're balancing risk with that potential for outsized returns.
It's a good reminder that investing isn't just about sticking to the tried and true. It's about having the courage to take some calculated risks on the companies you really believe in. But risk management is still key.
It's always.
They mentioned having that 24% in cash. What's their thinking there?
That high cash position, it's deliberate. They're being patient, watching for the right opportunities to actually deploy that capital. They specifically mentioned keeping an eye on BlackRock and Netflix. Both of those have seen their prices increase significantly.
So they're not just sitting on their hands with that cash. They're actively planning their next move. Like they're waiting for that perfect moment to strike.
Exactly. Ready to pounce when the market dips or corrects and then scoop up shares at a discount.
That's smart.
This kind of disciplined approach takes patience and a really clear understanding of your investment goals.
Yeah, it's a good reminder that investing is a long game, not some get-rich-quick scheme. And sometimes the best moves are the ones you don't make, like buying into a hyped-up stock at its peak.
Couldn't agree more. By staying focused on the long term and resisting that urge to chase every hot stock, they're positioning themselves for sustained success. But let's get back to those company analyses. Remember those deep dives into Procter & Gamble, British American Tobacco, and Anheuser-Busch InBev?
Yeah.
There's some really fascinating details in there I think we should unpack a little more.
Absolutely. What caught your eye?
For starters, the investor goes pretty deep on P&G's innovation pipeline. They list a whole bunch of new products that they've launched in just the past few years.
Like what?
Everything from like specialty shaving products to those eco-friendly laundry pods to skincare lines for specific demographics. It's pretty impressive.
Okay, so P&G is constantly innovating.
Mm.
But what's the strategy behind all those new products? Are they just throwing things at the wall and seeing what sticks?
That's where the analysis gets interesting. It's not just about launching new stuff for the sake of it. It's about staying ahead of consumer trends, capturing market share in those high growth categories, and maintaining their pricing power, even in a tough economy.
So they're being strategic with their innovation, which, given their strong performance, makes total sense. What about the other companies? Anything else stand out to you?
I thought that whole story about SK-II, the premium Japanese skincare brand, was pretty revealing.
The one that was hit by the anti-Japan sentiment in China.
That's the one. It just goes to show you, even global brands aren't immune to these geopolitical events.
Yeah, sometimes things happen that are just completely out of a company's control, and it can really impact their bottom line.
Exactly. It just highlights the importance of understanding the cultural and political landscapes where companies operate, especially in today's world. It adds another layer of complexity to investing, don't you think?
For sure. Investing isn't just about crunching numbers. It's about understanding the stories behind those numbers, the trends that are shaping the industries, and all the forces that can influence a company's success.
Absolutely.
So what else stood out to you in this update?
Well, the analysis of British American Tobacco had some intriguing details.
Oh, yeah. Like what?
I particularly liked the part where they dove into the heated tobacco products.
Comparing Batiste Glow to Philip Morris's IQOS.
Yeah, that was a good one. They even mentioned user feedback, like how some people find the Glow kind of bulky, but they like the informative display. It just shows that consumer preferences can really vary and companies need to be, constantly adapting.
Absolutely. And let's not forget that whole comparison of their market valuations.
Oh, right. How can two tobacco giants with such similar revenue have such dramatically different market caps?
That's the million-dollar question. What was their explanation for that?
Well, it all boils down to their strategies for navigating the changing landscape. Philip Morris has really embraced the non-combustible market, and it's clearly paying off for them.
And B8 is, well, they're playing catch-up.
Hoping that their lower valuation will attract investors who believe they can, close that gap. It's a real underdog story.
It'll be interesting to see how it plays out. What about Anheuser-Busch InBev? Any more interesting tidbits from their analysis?
Oh, there are a few. Did you know that Corona is actually the top-selling beer globally?
No way.
Yeah.
I knew it was popular, but the top.
And they're even brewing it locally in Germany to meet the European demand.
Wow. But wait, doesn't Germany have those super strict beer purity laws?
Yeah.
How does Corona, with its corn, fit into all of that?
That's where it gets interesting.
Or lay it on me.
They couldn't use those traditional Bavarian breweries because of the Reinheitsgebot, which basically bans ingredients like corn.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to find a workaround, a way to brew Corona locally while still using their original recipe.
So navigating local regulations, but keeping their brand intact. Smart. What about Budweiser, though? How are they doing in their home market?
Well, they've got a pretty creative marketing campaign going on over in England.
Oh, yeah. What are they doing?
They're featuring Jeff Hurst, the football legend.
Right.
Playing on the nostalgia of England's 1966 World Cup victory.
I love it.
They even came out with a limited edition Bring It Home can.
Tapping into that national pride. Classic marketing.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got this global beer giant with its star performers, its struggling brands, and its creative campaigns. But what's the investor's overall takeaway on ABI? Are they still holding on to that that pain money philosophy, hoping for a turnaround?
They seem to be. They believe the market has overreacted to ABI's recent struggles, and they see the stock as undervalued.
Why is that?
Well, they point to the company's strong free cash flow as a sign of its underlying strength.
So they're looking past the short-term ups and downs, and they're focusing on the fundamentals.
Exactly. And speaking of understanding the investor's mindset, there's one more interesting detail in this update. Remember that 24% cash position?
The waiting for the right opportunity fund.
That's the one. Well, they specifically mentioned keeping an eye on BlackRock and Netflix.
Oh, interesting.
Both companies have seen some pretty big price increases recently.
Right, right.
And they'd like to add to their positions in both, but they're waiting for a better entry point.
So they're not just hoarding cash. They're actively planning their next moves, like strategizing, you know?
Exactly. They're trying to stay a step ahead. And I think that's what really separates successful investors from the ones who are just following the crowd.
It's about doing your own research, having your own convictions, and being disciplined enough to stick to your strategy.
Yeah.
But it's also about being adaptable, you know,
yeah.
Recognizing when the market's throwing a curveball or presenting a new opportunity.
Absolutely. Investing is a dynamic process, and this investor really seems to embody that.
Okay, so we've covered a lot here. We've looked at their investment philosophy, their specific holdings, their strategy for navigating the market. But what does it all mean for our listeners?
That's a great question, and I think that's exactly where we should focus our attention as we head into the final part of our deep dive.
So we've journeyed through this investor's portfolio. We saw their Icahn stocks, those steady earners.
And got some hints about what might be in those high growth motor and favorite in categories.
But you know what's really stood out to me?
What's that?
How personal investing really is. It's not just about some magic formula or chasing the latest hot stock. You know?
Right. It's about so much more than that. It's about your own goals, how much risk you're comfortable with, even your own like beliefs about the world and where it's headed.
It's like their update wasn't just a spreadsheet. It was a window into their like their whole mindset.
Exactly. Take how they approach risk. They've got that solid foundation with the Icahn stocks, but they're not afraid to take a chance on something like a BT, hoping for a big payoff down the line.
And that 24% in cash?
Yeah, that's strategic.
It's not just sitting there. It's waiting for the right moment for those companies they're watching, like BlackRock and Netflix. Reminds me that patience is as valuable as any stock tip. Sometimes the best move is just, well, waiting.
And when those opportunities do pop up, this investor seems ready to pounce. They're not afraid to go against the grain, like with Beatty, if they think the potential reward is worth the risk.
So for our listener, what's the takeaway from all of this? We've seen this person's choices, their analysis, their ups and downs. What can we actually learn from them?
I think the biggest lesson here is that there's no one right way to invest. What works for this investor might not work for someone else. It all starts with knowing yourself, your financial goals, how much risk you can handle, and your own vision for the future.
It's like they've given us a framework, not a rule book. We can see how they think, how they make decisions, and then try to apply those ideas to our own, you know, our own unique situation.
Right. Like their focus on innovation, they clearly value companies that are always evolving, always changing, whether it's P&G with its new products or Philip Morris with its shift to those non-combustible products.
And they pay attention to those global trends, how those geopolitical events affected SKT or how they recognize Corona's global reach. That's huge in today's world.
It's about figuring out what you value in a company, what trends you see shaping the future, what risks you are okay with taking.
And then, just as important, how do you stay disciplined? This investor obviously has a plan, and they're sticking to it, even when things get a little rocky. They're not letting emotions get in the way.
Exactly. Investing is a marathon, not a sprint. There will always be ups and downs, surprises, and, well, disappointments too. But if you stay focused on your goals, do your research, and manage that risk, you definitely increase your chances of success.
So the best advice we can give is to, I guess, use this deep dive as a starting point. Take what we've learned, apply it to your own situation, and keep exploring, right?
Absolutely. Keep learning, keep asking those questions, and be ready to adapt. The world of investing never stands still, and the best investors are the ones who can change with it.
Well, this deep dive has given us a lot to think about. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
And remember, the journey of investing is just as important as the destination.